Okay, so as I said earlier, we're starting a new session at the class this week, looking at the refuge tree, of the Triratna Buddhist order. And so tonight I'm going to give a talk introducing the refuge tree. I've got a refuge tree behind me which I will unveil at a dramatic moment during the presentation. And I'll explain a little bit about what the refuge tree is and what its significance is. And then over the next, I think, two and a half months, we'll have a series of talks unpacking different aspects of the refuge tree, which really includes the whole of the Buddhist tradition, you could say that, the whole history of Buddhism, the whole scope of Buddhist teaching is contained within this image of the refuge tree. So there's a lot in it, and we'll go through it little by little as the weeks go by. So you could say that the spiritual life, I mean, is described as a path or a journey. You could say the spiritual life is like a journey that takes us from our usual mundane experience, you could say, which is conditioned by craving, by aversion, by spiritual ignorance, in a way from everything that's familiar to us, to the unconditioned state of enlightenment itself, which is a state of unlimited wisdom, unlimited compassion, complete spontaneity. And then progressing along the path, well, we go through a process whereby we gradually transform our energies and, if you like, transfer our emotional reliances from conditioned experiences to unconditioned ones. And this process of gradually transferring the focus of our emotional reliance, you could say, is known as going for refuge. So in a way, going for refuge really means putting our trust in, putting our faith in, placing our hearts upon, placing our emotional reliance upon. And of course, you know, all of us as human beings go for refuge, place our emotional reliance on a whole range of different things. You know, for many of us, it's our careers, our jobs, our families, our finances, our children, our homes. All of these are, you know, big sources of refuge for us. But if we look more deeply into this, we start to realise that, well, all of these things are certainly subject to impermanence. So all of these things can change. All of these things, in a sense, have a kind of insecurity built into them. And for this reason, because they're subject to impermanence, because all conditioned things are subject to impermanence, going for refuge to these types of things can become a source of suffering for us. As any of us will know, if we've ever suddenly lost our jobs, for example, or you know, if a relationship comes to a sudden end, or we find ourselves suddenly dealing with an illness or a bereavement. In these moments, in a sense, through the experience of loss, through the experience of change, we come to realise that these refuges, these conditioned refuges, have got this element of insecurity built into them. And we can see that the spiritual life, the process of the spiritual life, has gradually, if you like, coming to terms with the impermanence of conditioned things, of gradually letting go of our emotional reliance on these conditioned refuges, and developing more and more of a sense of reliance on the unconditioned, reliance on reliance on our own capacity for wisdom and compassion. But even saying this, even trying to explain this, actually is quite difficult. And it's difficult for a very, very simple reason. It's difficult to explain or get a grasp on going for refuge to the unconditioned, because we don't know what the unconditioned is. In a sense, the process of going for refuge is a process of moving from what is familiar to what is unknown. We're always moving into the unknown. And there's nothing really in our present experience that can give us any idea of what enlightenment would be like, what the unconditioned would be like. In the Dhammapada, there's a famous section where it says, when all conditions are removed, all ways of telling are removed. So the state of full and perfect enlightenment is said to be beyond concepts, beyond description. And so this fate, you know, this leaves us with a difficulty. One of the things that makes the spiritual life inherently difficult is that our conditioned refuges are very immediate and very familiar in a way. We know them. We can sort of reach out and touch them. Whereas the unconditioned refuges, the things that we're moving towards, can seem quite remote and abstract. And there's always this sense of moving beyond what we already know, what's already familiar to us. Even if what's familiar to us is limiting, is constraining, is full of dukkha, at least it's sort of familiar. Whereas the spiritual life is asking us to move out of that, to sort of go forth from what is familiar and move into the unknown. So we need ways to engage emotionally with the goal of our spiritual lives. And one of the ways that we do this is by engaging imaginatively with symbols and images which represent different aspects of enlightenment. So we have something which calls us to the spiritual path. We have a sort of inkling that there is a sort of higher dimension to things than we're already experiencing. And we want to sort of move towards that. But the way that we sustain that is by developing a sense of imaginative connection with images and symbols that kind of stand for what it is that we're moving towards. And we could say that symbols of enlightenment, images of enlightenment, act as a kind of bridge that take us between our own familiar experience and the mysterious and inconceivable qualities of the enlightened mind which we're trying to move towards. So, for example, and to give a very simple example, a very common example from Buddhism, you know, we talk about the three jewels. We talk about the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha as jewels. And, you know, we have on the case here, we have the image of the red jewel, the blue jewel, and the yellow jewel. And so a jewel can be a symbol of wisdom. It can convey the sense of something beautiful, something mysterious, something multifaceted, something very rare, something very perfect, something to be treasured, to be guarded. And also perhaps a jewel suggests something very sharp, something that has the capacity to cut through illusion, something that can break through to get to the truth. A jewel is also something very very long-lasting, very hard. So in this way, a jewel can capture a lot of the different aspects of wisdom. And to take another very common image, a lotus. We know that, you know, from the story of the Buddha apparently had a vision of humanity as a bed of lotuses, all these lotuses growing up out of the mud. And some of them sort of deeply buried in the mud, others pushing up through the water, breaking the surface of the water, and these beautiful lotus flowers opening to the light. And the symbol of the lotus can be a symbol of compassion, a symbol of a life moving towards compassion, the sort of softness and the fragility, the process of the sort of opening of the heart, the opening of the heart to love and to sensitivity. So if we contemplate the image of the lotus, we can come into contact with all the various different qualities associated with the cultivation of compassion. So we can contemplate these images like the jewel or like the lotus. And as we engage with these images in our imaginations, we can start to identify more and more with these enlightened qualities. One of the principles behind a meditation and sort of mental transformation is that whatever we put the focus of our attention on, we become more like, or we get more of. So if we dwell on anger and resentment, we'll become more angry and more resentful. But if we focus on the qualities of enlightenment, if we focus on loving kindness, and we focus on it over and over again, well, and loving kindness becomes stronger in us, it develops in us, it grows in us. So in a way, what we bring our attention to, we move towards in a certain way. So as we focus more and more and again on the ideals of wisdom and compassion, those ideals become stronger in us. They become a more and more sort of central part of our lives. So I think at this point I'll actually unveil the refuge tree. I feel I should have these little curtains. Maybe unveil a plaque or something. So I'm gonna just. So here we are. This is the image of the refuge tree. Yeah, beautiful, isn't it? So this is the refuge tree. And you could say that it's a visual representation of the central ideals of Buddhism, of the Buddha, the enlightened founder of the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha who represents enlightenment itself, perhaps represents our own innate capacity for wisdom and compassion taken to its ultimate extent. The refuge tree also stands for the Dharma, it stands for the teaching of the Buddha, and also for the truth, for the ultimate nature of reality that those teachings point to. And it stands for the Sangha, the community of the followers of the Buddha, the spiritual community. And this refuge tree is particular to our own Tri Ratna Buddhist movement. So it includes figures, including Sangharajita, who's represented here, the founder of the Tri Ratna Buddhist movement. And it's an incredibly rich symbol. This refuge tree has many different aspects to it, many different parts to it, many very different dimensions to it. And we'll be exploring and unpacking those elements over the coming weeks. So the most obvious thing to say is that the image is of a lotus tree, a lotus growing in the sky. It's actually sort of growing out of the sky. It doesn't have any roots that go into the earth. The lotus actually comes out of space itself. And the Buddha is at the center. Sitting here, this is the image of the Buddha. And all the other figures on the refuge tree are arranged around him, giving the sense that the whole Buddhist tradition grows out of the teaching and experience of the Buddha. So when we look at or when we visualize the refuge tree, we imagine this giant lotus made of light appearing in a vast open blue sky. And as the lotus buds open, we see the figure of the Buddha and then the other figures appearing out of the buds of the lotus. So although this image itself is a static image, it's an image it's a still image. Actually, what it represents is a kind of dynamic process. It's a dynamic image. We could almost see it, you know, on a big video screen. We could actually see the lotus opening and then branching out. And the idea is it's a sort of dynamic image of enlightenment unfolding. Enlightenment, if you could say, ramifying outwards through time and space, like the branches and the twigs and the leaves and the flowers of a tree. It's worth even just thinking about, you know, a tree. It's quite interesting, isn't it? The way a tree actually has a kind of centre of energy. It sort of draws energy upwards and then moves outwards, sort of ramifies outwards. It's sort of suggesting something about the way that enlightenment itself develops and spreads. So as I say, we're going to go into this image in a lot more detail over the coming weeks, but I thought I'd just say a little bit about what each of the various parts of the image represent. So in the middle we have three figures. We have the Buddha himself right at the centre, Shakyamuni Buddha. Then we have the Buddhas of the past and the future, Dimpankara and Maitreya Buddha, and I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. And then on this lotus here to the, well, to the left of the Buddha is a lotus that shows the enlightened followers of the Buddha. And they are represented as monks and nuns. So they were the human followers of the historical Buddha. And as far as we can tell, they were real people who lived at the time of the Buddha and were the sort of leading figures in the Buddha's own community. And they're known as the Arahants, which is something like awakened ones. And the Arahants were the ones who, well, they memorized the teachings of the Buddha and they passed them down to subsequent generations in the form that eventually became written down as the writings of the Pali canon, the original written teachings of the Buddha came down to us from this group of Arahants, of teachers. And then on the other side of the Buddha, almost balancing, we have these five very brightly coloured figures who are known as the Bodhisattvas. And the Bodhisattvas, you could say, are sort of mythical or archetypal figures that represent different aspects of enlightenment. So we have Avalokiteshvara and Tara, who are both figures representing compassion. You have Manjushri with his flaming sword, who represents wisdom. Vajrapani, who represents enlightened energy, and Kshitigarbha, who is said to descend into the hell realms to rescue beings from hell. So we have these figures that come from probably later Buddhist tradition, from the Mahayana tradition. And it's quite interesting that these figures are very much real people, and these figures are very much symbolic or archetypal. And then right at the top here we have we call the mandala of the five Buddhas. And I'm sure we will have talks about the mandala of the five Buddhas, but each of the five Buddhas represents a different aspect of enlightenment itself. And again, these are symbolic, archetypal figures representing different aspects of enlightenment. And then right at the top there's a figure called Vajrasattva, who's said to symbolize or embody primordial purity, primordial emptiness. So this part of the refuge tree is quite symbolic and quite sort of mysterious. And then on these other lotuses we've got on this lotus here at the back, we have a series of figures who collectively are known as the teachers of the past, the great teachers of the past. And we said that, you know, the original teachings came down from the original followers of the Buddha. But through the Buddhist tradition, the tradition went through many different stages of development. And so there were many historical teachers who reformulated the teachings in different forms to make them appropriate to the different conditions in the times that they were living. So at the top we've got a series of the sort of medieval Indian teachers, and I won't go into who they are, but they were the people who laid down the basis of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist ethics. And many of the aspects of the teachings that we follow now come from that later Indian phase of Buddhism. And then of course we know that at some point, probably around the sort of 6th, 7th century, Buddhism was taken from India to other countries. And these four figures here represent the great teachers of Tibet. So the teachers who formed the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And some of you may be aware of the figure of Padmasambhava, the famous Buddhist yogi, Buddhist teacher of Tibet. And this is Milarepa, the famous poet saint of Tibet. So we've got the sort of teachers of ancient India, the teachers of Tibet, and then at the front here we've got the teachers of China and Japan. Later on in its development, Buddhism spreads to, well, first of all to China, and then to Japan, where it took the form of Zen, Zen and Pure Land Buddhism. And each of these figures represents great teachers of the various different traditions. So here, I guess, you've got a sense of, if you like, the lineage of teachers. So, in a way, people have been practicing Buddhism, people have been communicating the Buddhist teachings continuously since the time of the Buddha's enlightenment, since, well, we think it's about the 6th century BC. So, you know, 2,500 years of continual transmission and communication of these teachings, taking different forms in different eras, moving to different countries, again taking slightly different forms as the Dharma has entered the different cultures of these different countries, coming right down to the present day. And here on the front, in front of the Buddha, in a sense between the Buddha and us, are a group of figures that are known as the teachers of the present. So in the middle, down the bottom here, is Sangharachitta, who is the founder of the Triratna Buddhist order, the Triratna Buddhist movement, which the centre is part of. And Sangharachitta himself lived in India for about 20 years. And while he was there, he took teachings from many of the different teachers of his time. He was actually in India at the time when the Tibetan teachers were forced out of Tibet at the time of the Cultural Revolution. So he came across some of the most revered Tibetan teachers of the 20th century, who are these figures here. And he had many other personal teachers from many of the different schools of Buddhism. So he had a teacher who was a Zen yogin, he had a teacher who was a Theravadin monk, he had teachers from the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So Sangharachitta himself synthesized a lot of these teachings from different parts of the Buddhist tradition. And in a way, it's really through Sangharachitta that we have access to the whole of this sort of rich tradition of Buddhism. And then these figures here, these are known as offering gods and goddesses. So they're these sort of celestial figures who are making offerings to the refugees. So they've got musical instruments and big baskets full of flowers, and they're, sort of expressing faith and devotion towards these figures. Gives you a very sort of little bit of an introduction. So in a way, what it's expressing is, well, it's expressing the kind of historical development of Buddhism, in a way, the lineage of teachings which comes from the Buddha himself down through history to us. And it's also suggesting, in a way, sort of other dimensions, that Buddhism is not just a sort of linear historical process. Maybe a way of explaining this is to go into the idea of the Buddhas of the past and the future. So the Buddhas, they're these three Buddha figures: the Buddha of the present, the Buddha of the past, and the Buddha of the future. And the idea is that, and certainly this is a Mahayana idea, is that there wasn't just one Buddha, you know, that there'd been many Buddhas through, the universe is very old, and during the countless millions of years that the universe has been in existence, there have been many Buddhas who've appeared at different times in different eras, and that all the Buddhas have discovered the same truth. So the important point is that the Buddha didn't make up the teachings. He didn't make enlightenment up. He rediscovered it. And the analogy is like somebody discovering an ancient ruined city in the jungle. So the truth of enlightenment is essentially the way things really are, the way things really have always been, whether a Buddha is around to see it or not. And a Buddha appears in the universe and discovers or rediscovers this truth, and then points the way for others to rediscover it. And that's really the meaning of these three archetypal Buddhas. And it's also the meaning of the sort of the mandala of the five Buddhas and the figure of Vajrasattva. In a way, the Buddha is a historical figure, and yet he sort of rediscovered something which is, in a way, an ultimate reality which is beyond time and space. And I won't say too much about the figure of the Buddha, because I know we're going to be, you know, talking about it a lot. But the Buddha here is depicted in what's known as the earth-touching mudra. So what this expresses, just at the simple level, is that he's a Buddha of this world, of this era. So at the moment of his enlightenment, he's said to have reached down and touched the ground. And this earth-touching mudra, in a way, it suggests that if we want to come into contact with reality, what we need to do is to bring awareness, bring attention to our ordinary human experience in the present moment. So this image of sort of touching the earth. And I guess what it suggests is that, well, at the centre of Buddhism, what's really sort of central in Buddhism isn't a theory or a sort of metaphysical position or a philosophy. Really, the central thing in Buddhism is an experience. You know, the central thing in Buddhism is the experience of the Buddha's enlightenment. And the experience of the Buddha's enlightenment is something that we can, in a sense, sort of touch into when we bring awareness to our own experience in the present moment. So this image of the earth touching mudra is very, very rich in meaning. But why is it called a refuge tree? So I suppose I've talked a little bit about the figures in the tree, and introduced a little bit about what they represent. But maybe I'll say a little bit more about this term, going for refuge, placing refuge. So at the time of the Buddha, when people joined the Buddha's community, they said that they were going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. They asked to go for refuge. That was their way of asking to join the Buddha's community. And this really means placing their trust in the Buddha, relying on the teaching of the Buddha. So going for refuge to the Buddha means placing our faith, placing our confidence, in believing that the Buddha did reach the end of suffering, and it's possible for us to reach the end of suffering too, through our own efforts, through our own spiritual practice. And going for refuge to the Dharma means putting our faith in the teaching of the Buddha, or at least to the extent of being prepared to take on the practices to see for ourselves. And the implication is that as we place our trust in the Buddha and the Dharma, we come under the protection of the Buddha and the Dharma. So our life and well-being are protected by our spiritual commitment. We're protected from the suffering caused by our own negativity. And going for refuge to the Sangha really means putting our faith and trust in the community of the Buddha's disciples. And traditionally, it's always said that the term Sangha is used in two ways. First of all, there's the Arya Sangha, the Greater Sangha. And the Greater Sangha means the great teachers of the past who realised the truth in their own experience. So the Arya Sangha is really the Sangha of the Buddha's enlightened followers through the ages, the people who've realised directly in their own experience that the Buddha did gain enlightenment because they've gained enlightenment themselves. But if we're not lucky enough to come across the Arya Sangha directly, we begin by making contact with the ordinary Sangha. And the ordinary Sangha means the community of practitioners following the Buddhist path. So going for refuge to the Sangha means joining, feeling part of a community of practitioners, making friends with, practicing with others who are following the path, being supported by others who follow the path, and supporting others who follow the path. Well, this is going for refuge to the Sangha. And I thought I'd just say a couple of other things about other points about the refuge tree. So, as I say, the image of the refuge tree, well, it depicts archetypal forms, symbolic forms that, in a sense, represent aspects of enlightenment. And in Buddhist tradition, this is the refuge tree, and these images, they belong to a domain of experience which is known as the Sambhogakaya. And the Sambhogakaya means something like the body of mutual bliss, or the realm of archetypal form. And I think the idea behind this is quite interesting. So the idea of the Sambhogakaya is that it's a level of experience that comes between the realm of conditioned experience and the realm of ultimate reality. So in a way, everything that we're used to belongs to the level of conditioned existence. And we know from the text that enlightenment itself belongs to the unconditioned, which is inconceivable, which is beyond all language, beyond all images, beyond all ways of communicating. But that between the two, there's this level known as the Sambhogakaya, which is almost like a kind of meeting place or an overlapping place between our ordinary experience and ultimate reality itself. So it's a kind of meeting place between the conditioned and the unconditioned. And the idea of this is that it's a meeting point from our side. So in other words, when we engage imaginatively with the image of the refuge tree, we're kind of approaching, coming into contact from our side with the unconditioned. But the idea is that the unconditioned is also alive and responsive and conscious from its own side. So as we visualize figures representing enlightenment, we also cultivate a sense that they are looking back at us as well. So that, you know, the nature of ultimate reality comes to meet us from the other side of the Sambhogakaya, if you see what I mean. So when we visualize figures representing enlightenment, we also cultivate a sense that, in a sense, they are looking back at us, that they're aware of us, responding to us with compassion. And probably the most important thing about this symbol, and about really all of these symbols of enlightenment, is that that we respond to their beauty. You know, these images are very, very beautiful. The colours and the forms can evoke a sense of beauty and significance and sublimity in us they can give us a sort of intimation of the spiritual ideal. And as we contemplate these images, as we open ourselves to the influence of the beauty of these images, then it can have an uplifting effect on us, taking us out of the, you could say, the mess and the complexity of our day-to-day experience, and putting us in touch with the possibility of higher states of being and consciousness. So beauty can take us beyond our normal limited experience. It can take us beyond our normal sense of ourselves, and potentially gives us a sort of glimpse of the potential of something higher that we want to move towards. So I hope that's given you a bit of an introduction to this image of the refuge tree. As I say, it's an image that portrays in visual or symbolic forms the core experiences and values of Buddhist spirituality. You could say that the Buddha represents the truth. The Buddha represents our innate capacity to discover the truth in our own experience. And the refuge tree, in a way, sort of tells the story of how this realization has been passed down to us through the teachings and practices over 2,500 years, coming down to us so that today we're still able to practice and come into relationship with what the Buddha practiced and what the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. And when we call to mind the Buddha and the refuge tree, we try to, reawaken our connection to that lineage, a sense that, we're a living part of that whole tradition which goes back to the Buddha. So you could say, in a sense, the momentum that started with the Buddha's enlightenment experience 2,500 years ago is still carrying on, and it's still carrying on through the transmission of the teaching, here and now in Brixton on a Wednesday night. So in a way, when we contemplate this image, we're trying to give a sense of sort of living connection with this process of transmission, you could say. And hopefully, if we can do this, this will develop a sense of, of gratitude, a sense of the sort of preciousness of the opportunity to practice, and even the sense of sort of opening ourselves out to blessings coming to us from another dimension of experience. So hopefully that's given you a sense of what the refuge tree is about, and also a sense of how we try and engage with the refuge tree, how we try and use the refuge tree, in a way, not just as a nice, pretty picture, but as something which is a kind of living part of our spiritual practice, how it can actually help us to develop a sense of connection with our own spiritual aspirations and help us sort of move towards those in a practical way. So that's